President Donald Trump spoke by phone last Saturday night with Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. It was a routine diplomatic call from one capital to another, except for one thing. President Trump invited President Duterte to visit the White House. It was an invitation that surprised even Trump's own advisors. Why? Because the Filipino leader has been accused of leading a vigilante war on drug traffickers that has killed as many as 7,000 people, many of whom had no involvement in the drug business. He himself has boasted that he personally killed 3 people in his previous job as mayor in the southern Philippines. Whether President Trump intended to or not, his invitation sent the message that human rights ranks low in his America First strategy. That wasn't all that happened this week. In a meeting with State Department employees, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that American human rights values remain as strong as ever. But he then said they should be separated from American foreign policies.
Policies can change. They do change. They should change. Our values never change. It doesn't mean that we don't advocate for and aspire to freedom, human dignity, and the treatment of people the world over. We do. I think it's really important that all of us understand the difference between policy and values. And in some circumstances, we should and do condition our policy engagements on people adopting certain actions as to how they treat people. They should. We should demand that.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox, discuss what he has said he will do, and assess the obstacles and opportunities he could confront. This week, we're talking about human rights.
And with us to help examine that issue is David Kramer. David is the Senior Director for Human Rights and Democracy at Arizona State University's McCain Institute for International Leadership. Before that, he was president of Freedom House. And David is a State Department veteran, where he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, among other topical responsibilities. David, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So the quote from Secretary Tillerson in some ways doesn't raise anything new. This is a balance of issues that I think a lot of administrations have grappled with. But there's also been, I think, sort of an arc of policy regarding human rights. David, can you talk a little bit about what that sort of consensus has been?
I think for decades, the United States has been a leader in trying to advance the cause of human rights, freedom, democracy around the world, really going back to the end of World War II, but particularly picking up steam in the 70s and especially in the 1980s with the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy. Ronald Reagan was a strong believer in these issues. And that's continued, Republican, Democratic administrations throughout the years. And I think the belief behind it is that a world in which freedom expands, a world in which human rights are respected, where democracy grows, is a more prosperous, safer world, and that's a world that's in U.S. interests.
And the U.S. has been often in the vanguard of what they call these naming and shaming reports. They have annual reports on all sorts of things, but the State Department report in particular is a much watched one, and it sometimes creates uncomfortable moments for even U.S. diplomats. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the U.S. in sort of being at the forefront of these in terms of as a matter of the work of the State Department, the work of government agencies, how much it's infused in their work?
In fact, the report that you're talking about, the annual human rights report, is required by Congress. Congress is the entity that created the bureau within the State Department that works on democracy, human rights, and labor issues. So it's Congress, it's the executive branch that have worked hand in glove in trying to advance these issues. The report offers assessments of every country in the world except our own country, the United States, and it is often very critical of regimes that are cracking down on opposition, on civil society activists, on media, and it's widely read. It's carefully watched by countries and often is the source of criticism, people saying the United States has no business critiquing other countries.
And David, I'm struck that you have emphasized the bipartisan nature of U.S. policy on human rights, spotlighting human rights abuses around the world. And you pointed out quite correctly that human rights were very important to Ronald Reagan. After all, he called it the Soviet Union the evil empire,
exactly.
Not just the threatening empire, right, or the big empire, but the evil empire, making a moral judgment about that. why is it that human rights became sort of one of the few bipartisan issues in foreign policy?
It stems from the belief that, particularly coming out of World War II, the main threats to the United States came from the fascist regimes, Nazi Germany, of course, and the belief that countries where human rights are not respected, where governments rely on cracking down on opposition, on journalists, on civil society, the way they treat their own people is often indicative of how these regimes will behave in foreign policy. And so if they're not respecting their own population's human rights, then they're likely not to respect principles of sovereignty, territorial integrity. And the feeling is that unless you engender more respect for human rights in a country, you're likely to see problems extend beyond the borders of that country. So, for example, in the case of Russia in 2014, Russia, which under Vladimir Putin has become a very repressive regime and country, invaded Ukraine. And so Putin didn't really respect the human rights of his own people and decided that the rights of Ukrainians didn't matter particularly either.
Another Republican president for whom human rights issues were a significant issue would be George W. Bush and his whole freedom agenda, which was characterized certainly his first term in office, and his second inaugural address put a spotlight on it.
That was the theme of his second inaugural address, absolutely right. And it became an important issue for him, I think, particularly after the main reason for going into Iraq didn't really pan out, finding the weapons of mass destruction. And so the rationale became trying to turn Iraq into a democracy. It obviously has been an enormous struggle that has fallen far short. But it did infuse the president with this feeling that the United States did have a role to play in trying to advance the cause of democracy and freedom around the world. He got tested early on. A month after he gave that speech in January 2005, he met with then-President Putin and raised concerns about what was happening in Russia. Putin responded with nearly an hour-long monologue. And frankly, that wound up being one of the last times the president raised human rights concerns with Putin until Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008. So for Bush, those issues really did matter, and I think he believed it genuinely. I think when we saw President Obama come into office, President Obama took a view that the invasion of Iraq discredited and undermined the notion of democracy promotion. And in fact, in an interview with the Washington Post editorial page 5 days before he became president, President Obama explicitly said you cannot promote democracy through the barrel of a gun. And I think under President Obama, and I don't mean this in a partisan way, having served in the Bush administration, there's plenty to criticize in the Bush administration, but I think for President Obama, these issues just didn't have the same value and importance as President Bush attached to them, even though President Bush and the administration didn't do a consistent job in trying to apply his vision.
Well, certainly President Obama has been described by some people as more of a foreign policy realist, and traditionally realists are seen as de-emphasizing what happens within a country's borders, focus much more on what a country does outside of its borders. But with all of that as a backdrop, how are we to make sense of the Donald Trump administration on the issue of human rights?
Well, it seems that the Trump administration is downplaying human rights. We even heard this in the campaign, a sense that pressing a country on human rights is interference in that country's internal affairs. And I think in the recent events that we've seen with the phone calls to President Duterte and the leader of Thailand,
which has a military junta that runs the country,
been in power since 2014, where there's been some serious repression and problems in Thailand. So President Trump has gone ahead and invited the leaders of both of those countries to the United States.
When we had President el-Sisi of Egypt come, and I note that President Obama steadfastly avoided having el-Sisi come to Washington during his presidency.
Absolutely, and I think rightly so. Let's remember that el-Sisi came to power through a coup, even though the Obama administration refused to call it a coup.
Went to great lengths to avoid using the C word.
To many in the Congress's consternation, absolutely. And there were thousands of people killed after that event. And there's been a terrible crackdown, a state of emergency in place in Egypt for a number of years since. And President Obama did resist inviting President el-Sisi to Washington. President Trump met with el-Sisi even before he became president after the U.S. election in New York, and has warmly embraced the Egyptian leader despite the concerns on human rights. Now, I think the Trump administration would argue that that approach paid off in freeing the Egyptian-American activist who had been in Egyptian jail for 3 years. Frankly, I think that was a pretty easy thing, a freebie for Sisi to do in order to engender goodwill with President Trump.
Even under Obama, then, there hasn't been sort of a U.S. megaphone on human rights, but there is still this kind of nuts and bolts practice of promoting, whether it's democracy promotion, whether it's defending human rights activists in certain countries at the UN, in various U.S. agencies, in the U.S. annual reports. How do those things then change, or what have we seen changes already on some of those fronts? Do we see that as maybe an area where there's still going to be a U.S. role?
Funding for this kind of work from the U.S. government to NGOs who carry out the actual programming declined under
NGOs
President Obama.
NGOs being non-governmental
organizations. And I headed one, Freedom House, which did receive significant funds and grants from the U.S. government. The funding, not just to Freedom House, it stayed more or less the same, but to some other organizations, but overall declined under President Obama. But I think just as important, President Bush thrived on meeting with activists. He just loved engaging with them, showing that the president of the United States cared about their situation, about their plight. I met with some of the activists after the president would meet with them, including in September 2008 in New York, and they were incredibly moved and touched that the leader of the free world would be interested in their situation. President Obama rarely met with activists, and I think that was a mistake. The time of the president is one of the most valuable resources he or she has. And it is, I think, an important investment, though, of the president's time to meet with civil society activists, to meet with dissidents, to meet with people who have been improperly jailed in another repressive country, and to show them that the United States stands with them, to show solidarity with these people. And President Obama didn't do enough of that, in my view. And President Trump, we'll see if he puts that on his agenda.
So you said funding started to go down under President Obama. You're seeing signals that that could continue under President Trump. There's still, obviously, a U.S. voice at the U.N. where we have seen Ambassador Haley speak out on human rights already.
Yes.
and mention as a priority. Certainly, Ambassador Power before her was of the same mind and used that bully pulpit. But as you say, I guess we're going to have to see both rhetorically as well as in practice whether the U.S. steps up and defends human rights on the various fronts where it's been active for years.
And what you said, Bob, is very important, which is we have seen senior officials in the Trump administration express interest and support for the state of human rights around the world, criticizing what happened, say, for example, on March 26 in Russia. State Department issued a good, strong statement condemning the crackdown by authorities in Russia against protests throughout the whole country. That said, the tone really does have to be set at the top. And even when the tone is set at the top, as it was in the Bush administration, often the bureaucracy won't follow through. So even if you get the president to demonstrate interest in these issues, it doesn't mean that the rest of the administration will follow. When President Obama didn't show much interest in these issues, even with the most dedicated people in the administration, like Samantha Power or Tom Malinowski on these issues, it was harder to push on these issues because at the top there didn't seem to be the interest. Now, with Secretary Tillerson and his comments at the State Department on Wednesday, it wasn't a great message to send to human rights activists, to civil society, to groups here in the United States that work on these issues. And I do think that there is a growing concern in the democracy human rights community here in the U.S. and beyond that these issues are being marginalized, they're being sidelined, and that the administration is taking a very realist approach, despite the strong statements that you may occasionally hear from Ambassador Haley or others in the administration.
I'll note that when Secretary Tillerson was in Moscow earlier this year, he met with President Putin. He quite noticeably did not meet with any opposition leaders in Russia, and I think that sort of is consistent with the message he gave.
Or even NGOs or people in those fields.
He met with officials at the Kremlin, and that was it. And so I think this is really consistent with the remarks he made at the State Department. But I'd like to sort of engage the argument that I think underlies what it is that Secretary Tillerson has said and what I see in the comments by President Trump, which is that the United States, one, is not a good messenger for this. President Trump, in one of his interviews, was asked about Russia's human rights record, and President Trump said basically no one to speak as well, argument being that
It was worse than that. He was asked about, you know, Putin being a killer.
We have killers too.
Right.
I don't remember the exact quote. Yes. I don't want to mangle it, but point taken.
We're not innocent either.
We're not innocent either. So, but beyond that, you have the situation of President Trump essentially arguing that we have interests to pursue and we're not going to be very effective in getting other people to change their behavior, and B, we should be focused on advancing our own interests because over the last several decades, other countries have taken advantage of us. So what's wrong with that message?
So the problems we face in the world come from non-state actors and authoritarian regimes that show no respect for human rights. We have disagreements sometimes with France, with Germany. We did in 2003 at the time of the war in Iraq. But we were able to get past those disagreements, and we didn't have such tensions between Berlin and Paris and Washington that would cripple the relationship or cause further problems. With the governments in Moscow and in Beijing and Pyongyang, the problems we have are rooted in just a fundamental difference in values, a fundamental difference in the way we govern our systems. And those regimes rely on suppression, cracking down, eliminating threats, whether real or perceived. And when they do that, they then have to perpetuate that kind of governing because they also engage in corruption. Corruption and authoritarianism often go hand in hand. Even though President Xi has launched an anti-corruption campaign in China, it's still a huge problem. Corruption in Russia is out of control. So when you have corruption accompanying authoritarianism, this then becomes a self-perpetuating mechanism. These leaders cannot afford to give up power. And when they can't afford to give up power, they will resort to whatever measures necessary to stay in power, including calling the United States a threat to their existence, including invading neighbors, as we've seen Russia do in 2008 with Georgia, 2014 with Ukraine, go into Syria simply to flex muscles and show that they will come to the aid and assistance of their friends and allies, and fill voids that we might leave on occasion. So it becomes a more unstable world if we fail to see that human rights and democracy and freedom are not as important as the other issues. Those of us in this community aren't saying that human rights should drown out energy and economic interests, should trump, if you will, security interests. What we're saying is it's like a three-legged stool. There are energy economic interests on one leg, security counterterrorism interests on a second, but there are human rights and democracy interests on that third leg of the stool. And if you shortchange that third leg, the stool becomes unstable and might tip over.
Are there any examples in which the United States putting pressure on countries for the human rights record, naming and shaming, as Bob mentioned earlier, actually worked, produced changes in behavior?
Yes. I mean, there have been political prisoners who have been released in you could argue that perhaps it wasn't the naming and shaming, but it was more the engagement that President Trump had with President el-Sisi to get the activists out of prison. But in the naming and shaming, there are countries out of fear and concern for sanctions or simply bad publicity who have released activists. It has happened in Russia, where the United States has weighed in, including back in the Soviet times, where the United States would weigh in on dissident cases. The whole Sakharov case, of course, where Western pressure, it took a long time, but wound up getting released
under
Gorbachev.
Well, but that's an interesting point to make. I mean, Elliot Abrams, who's our colleague here at the Council on Foreign Relations, has a book coming out on U.S. democracy and human rights policy. And one of the arguments that Elliot makes in the book, and he's made it for a long time over the course of his career, is that by putting pressure on other governments publicly and privately, that actually provides great benefit to these civil society organizations, people fighting for human rights, it inspires them. And he tells a story, and I think many Soviet-era activists talk about how much they were inspired by Ronald Reagan getting out and saying that Soviet behavior was wrong and they would be harshly judged by history, realizing that Reagan's ability to actually change conditions in the Soviet Union were close to nil, but it was inspirational and for that reason mattered a lot. And speculation that in the reverse, if you hadn't had that kind of encouragement, a lot of people would have given up hope and it would have given the regime much more freedom to suppress human rights and other things.
I'll give you another example that goes back to the 1970s when the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was passed in the United States that denied most favored nation status to the Soviet Union because they would not allow, in particular, Soviet Jews to emigrate. It didn't specifically apply or exclusively apply to the Soviet Union, but it was focused on the Soviet Union. Emigration for Soviet Jews vastly improved as a result of the naming and shaming of Jackson-Vanik, the actual passage of the legislation, the denying of MFN, most favored nation status
to
the Soviet Union.
That's a provision that allows, makes it easy
normal
to
trade.
Trade.
Exactly.
And it's worth noting that that was very much not favored by the administration at the time, Nixon administration in particular,
exactly.
Where detente had started to fire up with the Soviet Union, and they saw that as a huge complicating factor, to say the least.
Absolutely. And let's fast forward to 2012, again, sticking with Russia, where the Congress, by huge bipartisan majorities, passed what was known as the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law and Accountability Act that imposes sanctions on Russian officials engaged in gross human rights abuses, including the murder of the lawyer Sergei Magnitsky in 2009. And we saw a pretty vicious Russian reaction. What did Putin do when that legislation passed and President Obama signed it? Again, the Obama administration did not support the legislation, but Congress passed it by a veto-proof majority. He banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American citizens. A terrible move, but it reveals the kind of person that Putin is, that he would deny American citizens the opportunity to give a loving home to Russian orphans. But in the process, he was also punishing the most innocent victims in his own society, Russian orphans.
So you just demonstrated the power that Congress has in this area, and that bipartisan consensus seems to still exist for whatever other differences that continue to be very rawly exposed in U.S. politics right now. Human rights seems to be an area where Congress will come together when it needs to. How do you see that playing out now going forward, just despite the comments from Secretary Tillerson about sort of achieving a new balance?
Well, it'll play out on several different levels. We'll see how it plays out on the issue of funding. Where the administration has proposed significant cuts to the State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development budget that would include hits for this cause, democracy and human rights. I think the Congress, Senator Graham, who chairs the subcommittee on foreign operations for this, has indicated he plans to restore as much of this funding as possible. You also have the issue of sanctions. Now, just this week, Senator Corker has indicated that the Congress—
This is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Exactly. That his committee will not go ahead and vote on legislation to codify sanctions against Russia for invasion of Ukraine and human rights abuses. Senator McCain and others have indicated they may find an alternative way to get that legislation attached to other pieces, other bills. So Congress can act through funding by supporting these causes. It can act by passing sanctions legislation, and it can also pass resolutions, which to some people might seem empty rhetoric, but to people who are the focus or the subject of these resolutions mean an awful lot. There's also commissions like the Helsinki Commission that has been around from when the Helsinki Accords were signed in 1975, a key part of which is human rights. There's the Lantos Commission as well. And so there are many ways that I think Congress, again, bipartisan, can demonstrate strong support for these things. But coming back to the naming and shaming, if I can, there's another example, and let's go back to the Philippines, where President Obama at the end of last year indicated his intent to raise human rights concerns about the extrajudicial killings that occurred since President Duterte came to office last June. And I think we all remember that Duterte, when he heard about this, responded by calling Obama the son of a whore and said he wasn't going to deal with the United States anymore. He was going to turn to China and Russia. So the critics of the naming and shaming could say Obama said he was going to raise these issues and it cost us good relations with the Philippines. Now President Trump is taking a different approach and has invited Duterte here. Duterte, by the way, has said he might not be able to fit it into his schedule.
Well, I would imagine there will be a lot of protests should Mr. Duterte show up in Washington, D.C.
I think he has a good sense of that, exactly. And frankly, there should be a lot of protests.
And I mean,
78,000 people killed since he became president.
President Duterte's talk about getting closer to China has so far been just that, talk.
Absolutely.
There's a great deal of reservoir of goodwill within the Philippines for the U.S.-Filipino relationship, and also a great deal of distrust in the Philippines for China. So I'm not sure how much of Mr. Duterte's public comments are about political rhetoric and trying to sort of make himself seem to be – or the Philippines in play vis-a-vis the United States and China. But I want to talk about sort of another sort of complaint that comes up often, David, in terms of talking about human rights policy, which is that the United States is wildly inconsistent. Mm-hmm. So for example, you see lots of editorial writers writing about it's terrible that President Trump has invited Mr. Duterte to come to the White House, but didn't see that much in the way of complaints when President Trump had President Xi at Mar-a-Lago, or when President Obama met Raul Castro. So this is this issue of consistency. Is it a problem that sometimes presidents sit down with people who run repressive regimes? Think of our friends, the Saudis.
We should – and I used to do this when I was in the government and I did it at Freedom House. We should admit that we are guilty of double standards. We should not pretend
I knew there was
that
a
we
short
don't
way
hold
of stating
double
that.
Standards. Yes. We should just do it because it happens to be true. There have been many people whose human rights records are pretty appalling who have been in the Oval Office. That said – we should make sure that a leader really earns an Oval Office visit or represents a country that has such overriding interests in other areas that an Oval Office visit would be warranted. But there's no question, particularly toward the Middle East, I would say, that U.S. policy has shortchanged human rights. As Saudi Arabia, you mentioned. Bahrain is another one where we have the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, and we have over the past few years have been pretty quiet about the crackdown in Bahrain. In it, throughout the whole 2011 series of developments in the Arab world, we weren't quite sure which side to come down on. One of the things, though, about those events in 2011 is they had very little to do with the United States. It wasn't about U.S. support for Mubarak. It was people who were fed up. And if we learn nothing else from those events, even though the Arab world remains a pretty unstable place in many parts, Tunisia is better off since 2011. And we have to remember two things. One is that as long as Gaddafi and Mubarak, all these leaders were in power, those countries had no possibility of moving in a more democratic direction or a freer direction. With them out of power, there's an opportunity, certainly no guarantee. Second thing we have to remember is these regimes seem stable until they're not. And we never quite know what the tipping point is here. And I think we do have to think ahead, which side do we want to be on? Whom do we want to be associated with if things start to fall apart? And if we stand by principle, if we stand with our values, while recognizing we have other interests as well, I think we'll at least be on the right side should things start to change in a country.
We're in a world now that, in addition to the concerns you pointed out about authoritarian regimes, is also dealing with its biggest humanitarian and by extension human rights crises, basically in the post-war era, it seems to be. That has antagonized some of the countries that are usually in the vanguard of promoting human rights, including the United States and the Western European democracies and so forth. What do you see are the principal challenges in trying to provide some sort of response, an effective response that not only can help lessen this you know, appalling state of affairs in terms of the refugees, for example, and also creating some sorts of equilibrium at home, because there are we're on the cusp of an election in France that where these issues are percolating. Obviously, the U.S. is still dealing with it on its own immigration policies. How do you see that? Issue of just major human rights and humanitarian concerns and the problem it creates in democracies and major democracies as well?
The refugee crisis certainly caused all sorts of problems in Europe, and Chancellor Merkel's willingness to accept many, up to a million coming into Europe caused a huge blowback. I think you can argue about the way she did it, but I actually commend the principal position that she took, particularly the Chancellor of Germany, given that country's history, to open its doors to refugees. And I think you have to distinguish between refugees and people seeking to emigrate to another country. That's a different category. But people who are fleeing for their lives from Syria, possibly other places, I think we all have an obligation to do what we can, whether it's to create safe zones inside Syria so that you obviate the need for people to cross the borders and seek haven elsewhere, or to open our doors to them, including here in the United States. We see this in Canada, which has taken a position of welcoming many Syrian refugees. Protecting the country is the top priority of the president. There's no question about it. And it's the top priority of every leader. But I think we also have an obligation to extend a hand when people are in desperate straits and see what we can do to help. The whole refugee crisis and the whole issue of immigration did create huge problems in Europe, where you had leaders in Hungary and elsewhere constructing a wall or trying to construct a wall and keep people from coming into their countries. We have to remember that treatment of minorities can lead to much bigger problems if not done properly. That Europe certainly has had a history of that, and I think Europeans need to be a little more open-minded to this while making sure that they protect their own population's interests.
David, I want to ask you a particular question because you spent time in the State Department. I think it is safe to say that the Trump administration has been slow, certainly relative to past administrations, to staffing up the State Department. Secretary Tillerson has given some indication in recent weeks that he's going to be even slower because he wants to figure out how to reorganize the State Department before he actually staffs it. To what extent does that matter in terms of handling the kinds of policies we're talking about right now? And I ask in part because what I hear from many people in the Trump administration is something along the following lines. Yes, we don't have political appointees. We don't necessarily need them. We have a lot of career staff who are taking these positions, and we have a secretary. Everything will be fine.
Well, having worked there at State for 8 years, I have enormous respect for the Foreign Service cadre and civil servants as well. Some of the finest
people. I
think it's
important to understand there are Foreign Service officers, but there are also career civil service officers.
Absolutely.
They have different training and different career paths.
And tend to be based here in Washington. They do have occasional opportunities to go overseas, but
FSOs are the ones most likely to go over.
Foreign Service officers are the ones who generally staff the embassies, exactly. And so there are very capable people in these positions on an acting basis. But you really do need to have people appointed in these confirmable level positions. And they can be, by the way, career people. They often are. Many of the assistant secretaries.
We're talking undersecretary, deputy secretary.
Deputy secretary, undersecretary, assistant secretaries that require Senate confirmation. And they can be either political appointees who are coming from outside, private sector, NGO world, or they can be career people who are rising up to a position. And it's that sort of seal of approval that you get from Senate confirmation that is important to give the real necessary direction and steer for the rest of the Bureau to follow. I think there is a lot to reorganize in the State Department. I would get rid of a lot of the special envoys that have been created over the years. But I think it seems to me you're going to keep regional assistant secretaries, the assistant secretaries responsible for Europe and Eurasia, for East Asia, for Africa, and so on. I don't think that's going to change. So I'm not sure what the holdup is there. And the bureau that I used to run, the Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Bureau, is congressionally mandated. So you can't eliminate that even if there was an inclination to do so. So go ahead
and it's not the only office in the State Department that is mandated.
Correct.
By law.
That is right.
Over the decades, Congress has identified areas where it thinks the State Department isn't doing enough, and one of its ways to respond to that is to create an office and say that office is going to be responsible because we want to have somebody we can call up, come to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, House Foreign Affairs Committee, and testify when we have a question.
Two examples of that, the Office of International Religious Freedom, which is at an ambassadorial level that requires Senate confirmation, and then the office that handles trafficking in persons.
And both have to provide those annual reports as well.
Annual reports, about. That's yep. Exactly right. So this is where Congress steps in because it thinks that the administration whether Republican or Democrat, is not doing enough on these specific issues. But so it does seem to me that even with a reorg, the problem with sort of pausing on appointments is that there is no pause button for the rest of the world. The rest of the world is not waiting while we get our act together and get a reorganization of the State Department or any other department. We have to do both things at the same time. We have to reorganize. We have to get people in place and deal with the crises of
every day. So we have to fly the plane and remodel at the same time.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Hopefully from the inside, but a little safer.
Well, on that note, we're going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick, recording engineer John Perry, and with special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Corey Cooper. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the President's Inbox.